Okay, I was talking about how I went to the University of Virginia appellate judges program. And before I went there, I was a lawyer. A lawyer who became a judge. I learned the law. I learned technique. I learned how to take a case from beginning to end. All the practicalities of the law is what I knew. But in Virginia, I learned that you don't learn the law by learning the law. At Virginia, I learned how to think about what it is that judges actually do. We learned that who we are is part of our own perception of history, our own perception of economics, sociology, ethics, and the philosophy of life. All these things form our judicial ideology. And we had a professor who was steeped in jurisprudence and the various philosophies of the law, which is what jurisprudence is. For example, he taught us about the law of positivism, which is the idea that law drives society. The role of coercion is in the law cannot be undervalued. So Jeremy Bentham, he's the most famous of all positivists. The idea was that you make a law, and once you make a law, the idea is the people who made the law went through all the different competing values and made a decision, and that's the decision, and everybody has to follow that decision. In other words, law drives society. You make a law, people follow it. One of the critics of the positivist school called it law with bayonets. We learned about critical legal studies, which is kind of an offshoot of the positivist school. And this is mainly leftist law professors who created this theory, which is the idea that law is power, that it doesn't matter who's on the bench. It matters. I mean, it doesn't matter what the law is. It matters on who is on the bench, because whoever is the judge makes his or her own law. The law can be out there, it can be a statute on the books, but you can interpret it one way or the other way depending on your ideology. So the idea behind critical legal studies is let's get people on the bench who think like us. Let's come to the perception, the realism that judges are nothing more than politicians, and that judges make the law depending on who the judge is. And then there was law and economics theory, and that's this famous Chicago school, which is simply this: the maximization of aggregate wealth and the promotion of allocative efficiency is society's greatest goal and will only be recognized by a freely operating market. And the whole idea behind this is the law should stay out of the way. Let the market decide everything. The market is moral, and all values and all morals are decided by the market. And that's law and economics theory. I could probably speak all day about it, but that's it in a nutshell. Then there was legal realism, which is the theory most espoused by Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. And that theory is law is experience. Something happens, a case is created, judges make a decision. That's an experience right there. The next case that comes along, it's a little bit different. You change the law a little bit to deal with that experience. So the law develops molecule by molecule, and that's how you make the law. And Holmes said morals and ethics have absolutely nothing to do with the law because they're inbred in the experience. A famous when he was a Harvard Law professor, a student asked him about a result. He said, "But sir, is that just?" And Holmes replied, "If it's justice you're looking for, then you should have gone to divinity school." And then there's the historicist school, which is that it's really the opposite of a positivism. Remember, positivism is law drives society. And the historicist school says, no, you got it backwards. Society drives the law. Until society accepts something as a given, the law will not be enforced. It won't be followed. So the idea was that laws are children of custom. To borrow from Buddha and his followers, to change the root is to change the tree. Culture lives in human beings. If you change the human heart, culture will follow. So I looked at all these things. I think all of the appellate judges that were in the program looked at all these different philosophies and then put ourselves in, kind of consciously or subconsciously, in a little niche about who we were. We were law and economics people, or we were realists, or we were historicists, or we were natural law people, or positivists. And I kind of put myself in the historicist school. I thought, yeah, that's right. Until people buy into something, the law won't be enforced. Once people buy into it, yeah, then the law will be a force. And I came away from Virginia with that idea in mind. In fact, I just spoke to a group a couple of years ago. Andy was there, the National Association of Law Students with Disabilities, and I described myself as an historicist. But since then, I've seen a few things happen. First, I've seen a lot of money go into judicial campaigns, state judicial campaigns. A lot of big money going into judicial campaigns. Millions and millions of dollars being spent to elect Supreme Court justices, the most famous of which, of course, happened in West Virginia, where Don Blankenship spent, $50 million on a judicial race, something like that? Gobs of money. And I talked to one of my, actually he's my wife's cousin, he's one of these operators who puts money together for judicial campaigns. And I said, judges aren't politicians. Why are you doing this? And his answer was, I want somebody on the bench who thinks like I do. I said, well, what if the person's dumb? He said, doesn't make a difference. I don't care if the person went to Yale or Podunk Law School. If he votes the way or she votes the way I want that person to vote, I'm going to give that person money. And I thought about that. And I thought, that just makes me feel, as a judge, it makes me feel uncomfortable, wormy, because we're not supposed to be like that. We're not supposed to be politicians. And I looked at the Sutton case, which is the United States Supreme Court case. And most of you are aware of that. That's the case involving the two sisters who were 20/200 without corrective lenses. But with corrective lenses, they were fine. They saw fine. And they wanted to be pilots. And United Airlines said, no, we have a threshold 20/100. So they sued. And the United States Supreme Court, even though the ADA, in my view, was very clear, the Supreme Court said, substantially limited in a major life activity means limited with or without mitigating circumstance, with or without correction. So since this person can see with corrective lenses, then this person is not qualified under the ADA. And I thought to myself, as I'm reading this opinion by Justice O'Connor, I thought, well, what about that part of the ADA that says if you are regarded as having an impairment, you come under the ADA? And they simply, they did answer that later in the opinion by saying, well, United didn't regard them as having an impairment because United simply had a threshold of 2100. So it had nothing to do with the sisters. It was all because of their job description. And I'm thinking, wow, talk about a kind of a strange way to read the clear interpretation, what I thought was a clear reading of the law. And then, with all these elections going on, people coming on to not only the state courts, but the federal courts, the United States Supreme Court, it suddenly hit me. Remember the V8 commercial a long time ago? I should have had a V8. Suddenly hit me that critical legal studies, that very ideal that I at Virginia had completely dismissed as being totally wrong, because that's not who we are. We are not people who do whatever we want. We are judges. We follow the law. I suddenly realized that they're right. They've been right all along. Judges will interpret the law the way they want to interpret the law. Carl Llewellyn was right when he said it's at the whims of judges. It can be whether a judge had a bad breakfast or a good breakfast. That's what Llewellyn said. And I now think that critical legal studies has a point, and that it, and as consequently, it's very important who is on the bench. So I've done a whole 180 from where I was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And this is what I think we need to do. I think we need to start getting involved, really involved, in who are going to be the next people on our benches, whether it be federal court or state court. And don't say, well, you know, ADA, federal, that's federal, because a lot of the cases, especially employment cases, end up in state courts. An employer won't hire somebody, comes up under the guise of rehire under the state law, and it has to do with how a judge perceives that case in his or her own experience. So this is what I advocate. I advocate that we do what the police unions do. We do what the Manufacturers and Commerce Associations do. We do what the pro-life people do. We do what the realtors do. And that is, we get out a questionnaire to all those prospective judges and we ask them point blank questions about how they perceive disability law. We do interviews. Interview the prospective candidates for endorsement purposes. Press releases outlining not only the endorsements, but why. Money really is only part of the game. The other part of the game is noise. If you give a press release, you spend a little money on a advertisement in the newspaper a week or so before the election explaining the endorsement, people are going to read that. And I'm convinced that society does drive the law in some ways. I'm convinced that Tony is right, that we've come a long way, and there are a lot of people on our side. And I'm convinced that it's not just liberals versus conservatives. One of the most conservative people in Congress is my congressman, Jim Sensenbrenner, and he's also one of the most fervent defenders of the ADA. So it crosses aisles. So it isn't whether a person's a liberal judge or a conservative judge or a Democrat or a Republican as far as we are concerned. The question is that person a person who understands persons with disabilities, our needs, our wants, what we need to see for society to develop in the future? And that is the challenge that we have. Okay, thank you. I'll give it over to David.
Thank you, Richard. First, let me let everyone know that Patrick, who had a seizure earlier, is walking, talking. He's taking a break for a little while, so I'm sure he appreciates everybody's patience. Thank you, Dr. Maher, and I want to acknowledge, although I'm not sure she's in the room, Lou Ann Blake, who hopefully will get many more acknowledgments today, who did tremendous coordination for this conference. When this session was being planned by the Planning Committee, the hope was to have some provocative ideas that would sort of help start off the couple days, along with Tony Coelho's amazing talk and Judge Brown's talk. So I thought I'd come up with one or two, and I have. So, and I decided to end the tension here right now by letting you know the end of my speech and then explain how I got there. It's 20 years since the ADA, as Tony mentioned earlier. So I thought I'd imagine the future and looking forward to the where we'd be at the end of the next 15 or 20 years. So the conclusion of my talk is that when the time comes, we should repeal the ADA. So hopefully nobody's going to walk out with that suggestion quite yet. So I want to set aside the legal precedents for a minute and talk about that future and imagine a future in which so-called disabilities are not relevant or increasingly irrelevant, and try to think about our relationships in the world, out in the world, and our relationships in our homes and our communities, and to try to awaken that world in our imagination and to try to charge all of us with trying to make real that world. So I start with the observation that fundamental for all of us is the need for relationships through participation in the world and our experience at home. And I want to talk about how that fundamental human need intersects with people with disabilities and without disabilities. So with regard to those two spaces, the landmark Law Review article by Jacobus Tenbroek, The Right to Live in the World, The Disabled and the Law of Torts, 1966, long before much of the development of the legal thinking that came in the decades afterward. He wrote at the very beginning of his article that as to man, nothing could be more essential to personality, social existence, economic opportunity, in short, to individual well-being and integration into the life of the community than the physical capacity, the public approval, and the legal right to be abroad in the land. To that right, I want to add a second fundamental right, which is the right to have a home, the right to have a place of one's own, to live in, to grow old in. I think that is equally basic to life. Louis Brandeis, 116 years ago in 1894, long before he was appointed to the Supreme Court, was hired by Alice Lincoln, a Boston philanthropist who crusaded for the rights of poor people. And he represented her at public hearings that took, I think it was 51 days, on the conditions in the public poorhouses in Boston. In his summation, he talked about home for those folks who he described as the outcasts of society. He said, "They call this a home for paupers. That place may be as clean today or any day as any place in Christendom. The food may be as good, the air may be perfect. You may have beds and woven wire mattresses as good as any that can be found. The attendance and the discipline and the work may all be there. But that place as it presented itself to us is as far from a home as one pole from another. It is the very opposite of a home in every particular." So I'd like to suggest that what binds Tenbrook's notion of being abroad in the world and Brandeis's description and evocation of what a home means is the possibility, the opportunity for positive and multiple human relationships, because they are essential to what makes us feel most vital, most significant, along with food and spirit and air. I think that is what really makes us human. So I want to talk for a few minutes about who the disabled are, both in terms of numbers, social isolation, and physical isolation, and then turn to how it might be in 20 years we might have no longer a need for the ADA. 54 million people, a lot of us have heard that number, in the United States are disabled, about 19% of the population, 12% with a severe disability. For older people, the number is higher, of course. It's increasing. For people 65 and older, 52% disabled, a 10% increase over the 42% about 10 years before that. Almost 30% of families in the United States have a family member with a disability. I won't give all the numbers, but we know that there are millions of folks who use wheelchairs, canes or crutches, people who are blind, deaf, have difficulty having their speech understood, and 16.1 million with limitations in cognitive functioning or have a mental or emotional illness or intellectual disability. Now, those numbers often don't mean a whole lot because those snapshots don't communicate a lot to me. But what communicates more are things like this. 25 years old, you have a 44% chance of having at least one long-term disability that'll last 3 months or more for somebody age 25. One out of every two women in the United States will spend some time in a nursing home, and one out of every three men will spend some time in a nursing home. Then there's 76 million people who are the baby boomers, and they're an increasing proportion of our population. In 2010, 13% were over 65 in our country. By 2040, it'll be 20%. The rate of aging within the census, the proportion, is increasing. By 2050, there'll be 88 million people in America over 65, and that more than doubles the 38 million people from 2008. Those folks plan to keep working. 69% of people between 45 and 74 either intend to work or are working during their so-called retirement. Then there's social isolation. People with disabilities, as we know, often live in relative social isolation compared to people without disabilities, and Tony Coelho referred to this, are much less likely to work full or part-time, 35% to 78%. Less likely to socialize with friends or relatives, less likely to go to church, synagogue, or mosque, and less likely even to go out to eat. But I found that the situation is even more grim with regard to more subjective indicators, and it's getting worse on the element that I'll talk about right now. Only 34% of people with disabilities are very satisfied with their lives, compared to 61% of people without disabilities. If you put together somewhat satisfied together with very satisfied, it's 74% versus 94%. So in other areas, like employment, education, people with disabilities are more satisfied over the last 20 years. With regard to being satisfied with one's life, the gap is increasing. People with disabilities are increasingly more dissatisfied relative to folks without disabilities than before. The gap has gone from 11% to 27% during the years since the Harris and National Organization of Disabilities poll has been taken. Physical isolation. There are tens of thousands of people living in residential institutions, people with disabilities. 2002, there were 69,000 nursing facilities, 28,000 mental retardation, mental health, and substance abuse facilities, 2,600 residential settings for people with intellectual or developmental disabilities, tens of thousands of state and county mental hospital inpatient beds, even more private inpatient beds, 1.8 million people in nursing facilities, and 98,000 folks living in large state or private, large ones, developmental disability institutions. So we have a great diversity of people with disabilities. They live a lot of places. But of course, people with disabilities, as we all know, have one trait that all of them share, which is their capabilities are altered in some respect. Other than that, the similarities disappear. But in addition to that, for people without disabilities, their capabilities are also all altered in some respect, or will be at some point in our lives. So we so-called temporarily able-bodied people might lose our sight, our speech, our mobility. The baby boomers are growing into the frailties of old age. People with one kind of challenge now might acquire another one. So that change means that all of us are subject to, or already are, a limitation in our ability to go abroad in the world, in Ten Brooks' phrase, or to have and maintain a life in our own home. So disability, or maybe we should call it altered capability, is not a special condition. We've all thought of that at one time or another. It affects all of us, and we all know that if designs work for people with disabilities, they work better for everyone else. So I want to talk for a minute about why not make all of our social employment and other structures work better for all of us. So I want to talk for a minute about universal design. People have thought about that. It's come up through barrier-free and accessibility sorts of notions. But that kind of universal design or inclusive design designs services, products, or environments to be usable by everyone to the greatest extent possible without the need for adaptation or specialized design. So we want to make things work regardless of the person's level of ability or disability. So we all know about the familiar. We know about physical access. We've all seen and worked with that. But that kind of vision, I think, is broader than simply physical access. It encompasses every field in which all of us here today work, all of us in disability rights, education, community integration, telecommunications, healthcare, and all the rest. I'm not the first to make that connection. One of the folks who designed and helped create the principles of universal design, Elaine Ostroff, in the Universal Design Handbook, she cited Brown versus Board of Education, already mentioned today, and she called it the milestone that marks the beginning of an approach to design that respects all users. Accessibility features that are a thoughtless add-on after the basic design of a place or product have a stigmatizing quality not unlike the segregated back-of-the-bus practices that were once the norm in the United States. So we need to think about access and universal design not just in terms of the physical environment, but in terms of allowing people, regardless of disability, to actively and meaningfully participate in employment, social functioning in their homes, and out in the world. So let me go over, for those folks who might not be familiar with them, the seven principles that have been enunciated for inclusive design. And as I talk about them, we can think about how they might be applied to defining or refining disability rights in legislation, in the courts, and the remedies we ask for violation of people's rights. First principle is equitable use. The design has to be useful to people with diverse abilities and appealing to everyone. The second is flexibility in use. The design has to accommodate a wide range of individual preferences and abilities and be adaptable to the pace of the user. The third principle is that there should be simple and intuitive use. The use of the design should be easy to understand regardless of the person's experience, knowledge, language skills, or current level of concentration. The fourth is perceptible information. The design should communicate necessary information to the user regardless of the person's sensory abilities and use all kinds of modes for presenting essential information. The fifth is tolerance for error, a good lesson for those of us who deal with folks of all sorts of disabilities, but in the intellectual, cognitive, or mental health area. The design should minimize hazards and the adverse consequences of unintended or accidental actions. Low physical effort is the sixth, and the seventh is that the appropriate size and space should be provided regardless of the person's mobility or other individual factors. So without trying to add here, which I think one could do, some other clarifications or additions for some other sort of domains, I think that these principles affect all of us and enable us, if they're followed, to better be in our own homes and out in the world. So obviously these principles aren't rights. The ADA maybe establishes some rights. A bunch of principles don't establish rights. The transformation of these kinds of principles into rights is in its infancy and is happening. Our disability discrimination, anti-discrimination laws have begun to do that. But the difficulty that I see is that those statutes focus on disability, not on inclusivity. We don't have a focus on how to include everyone. And in fact, one could say that those laws discriminate against people with disabilities by singling them out for labeling with eligibility criteria and with other things that often, as in the Sutton case, exclude people rather than include people. Until we figure out ways to envelop these principles of design, I think we will not have implemented what Ten Brook taught us about being about in the world and Brandeis reminded us about having our own homes. So these social goals that I guess I'm articulating here eventually become rights. It takes a while. Virtually all the social welfare legislation and constitutional rights we now recognize in this field used to be matters of gratuity or just a social good that was looked at upon mainly as a matter of charity. Eventually, we get change. People now in institutions never thought 30 years ago there'd be a right to live in the community. That's changed. So eventually, the social goals, the professional knowledge, best practices become the law. Ruby Moore, who's speaking today, and I, a while ago, presented to a United Nations conference an analysis of this issue, and we found, looking at different rights now recognized, that it takes 15, 20 years for the social value to be transformed into a legal right. So my vision for the future, 20 years from now, is one in which we don't need the ADA, the relevant provisions of the Air Carriers Act, the Architectural Barriers Act, the Fair Housing Amendments, the Right to Education laws, the Telecommunications Act, the Urban Mass Transportation Act, the Voting Accessibility Act, the Rehab Act, and there's more than 100 federal regulations on access for people with disabilities. I think we'll have air carriage that's designed for all of us, voting processes and machines that are designed for all of us, employment conditions and obligations will enable and embrace the accommodation needs of all workers, regardless of label or diagnosis. People who need in-home supports or other kind of assistance for activities of daily living will have them when they're needed. Attendance services will be commonplace. And these changes, I want to suggest, will be driven in part by the disability rights movement and advocacy. But I think, although I might hope otherwise, that we're not all that powerful. A more powerful force, I think, will be the tens of millions of baby boomers and their families who won't stand for exclusion as they live into their 70s, 80s, and 90s. But in the meantime, because we have to live through these 20 years, we need to seek legislation that applies inclusive design principles so that everyone benefits, and covered entities are obligated to that end. When we formulate remedies in court or otherwise under existing law, we should devise systems and structures that are less disability-centric and try to provide a relief that benefits all people, not just some people. And when we have moments and the leisure to strategize some long-term campaigns, we should keep in mind that fundamental need of all people for relationships that enable us to have a home, and in Tenbrook's words, to be abroad in the world. So when the time comes, I'm hoping that we're all ready to repeal the ADA. Thank you.
And thank you very much. As it happens, we have time for questions, and we are even before the original break time, so we have time possibly even for a few minutes, but it'll be a very few minutes of break. So if you have a question, please, we have a microphone carrier, so you'll get the microphone and you can state your name, please.
Yes, my name is David Wasserman. I'd like to ask the last speaker if in the legislation he envisions superseding the ADA and disability-specific legislation, he thinks it will be possible to dispense with counterparts to reasonable accommodation, undue burden. I mean, is the idea of universality an ideal or is it an enforceable goal? Are there going to be various kinds of fiscal and practical limits that need to be acknowledged by the law, or is that something that remains to be worked out?
David.
Well, I think my vision assumes some continuing economic development and progress over the years, and it makes obviously a lot of other assumptions. I don't think that the undue burden kind of reasoning will eventually be one that's acceptable. I mean, I think for a lot of us now who do advocacy today, we know and try to address the undue burden, fundamental alteration, all those exceptions. So I would suggest that legislation will increasingly disregard those kinds of arguments.
Dr. Tenbrook started with the proposition that you didn't need special legislation, but he was driven to writing it after a while. Other questions?
Sir, my name is Tara Tripathi. The understanding that I had, the vision that I'm trying to understand that you're trying to propose is that the discrimination, I mean, what ADA does is tries to remove the discrimination against the disabled people in the workplaces. Now, the vision you're suggesting is that there's no prejudice, it's just because the environment is such, the environment is disabling, that's why we are not able to do certain things, and that's why people do not hire us. Is it what you're trying to suggest, and there's no prejudice when it comes to the employers?
There's tremendous prejudice when it comes to employers and other people in our society. I think that as we begin to develop a culture that recognizes that all people are subject to disabilities, and we have now a third of the population's families have a member with a disability, that's going to increase. It's not going to be a third in 10, 20 years, it's going to be a half or more. So I think the change in society's sort of stigmatization of people with disabilities, I think, will produce a change in the law.
I'd like to also chime in here. You know, I go to conferences all over, not just judicial conferences, and I've heard people who are employment lawyers for management get up and talk about how employers can get around the ADA. And I hear this every year. So this is not going away anytime soon. You have attorney generals not only arguing that the 11th Amendment should give the states immunity from having to provide accommodations, but also saying that because the United States Constitution did not give a specific right to persons with disability, there is no such right under the Constitution. And therefore, Congress's actions are illegal. These are coming up every day. So to say that it's all going away, nobody's suggesting that. It's not going away. It's still a fight, and it's really important to carry the fight. But I do agree with David that over time, if we fight hard enough, and as more people get into the mainstream in employment situations and work with people who actually have disabilities, that culture will eventually accept this as an inclusive idea. So I do agree with David on that.
How many disabled judges are there in America? What that is to say, not that kind of disability, the other one.
I know there are more blind judges than there are deaf judges, I know that. As far as I know, I'm the only one left. There are no other deaf judges. There used to be four of us, but one retired. One was voted out of office. I don't know what happened to the third one. Kind of fell off the radar, and that left me. So I would like to have some. I'd like to have my own caucus. So you have to help.
Other questions?
My name is Candace Gradine. I recently attended an international conference on accessibility, and one of the points that was driven very strongly by a number of the participants was the fact that among all the strategies that have been mentioned to promote accessibility and inclusiveness for people with disabilities, one of the things that you don't see that much of in the United States versus some, at least in some European countries, is the idea that universal design and universal accessibility really pays, that it's profitable. One of the striking examples that was mentioned at this conference was, I think it was the city of Berlin in Germany, that is apparently quite accessible and almost universally accessible. In any event, there's a supermarket chain in Berlin that decided to make all of its stores completely accessible to persons with just about all kinds of disabilities. And after a relatively short time, and I think this has been sustained, their profit margin increased by more than 25%. And so one of the things that I wonder what you think of this is whether a strategy that really presses home the point that among all these other great things and also ethical arguments for accessibility and inclusiveness and universal design, given the nature of our culture and our capitalist-driven culture, that it's also profitable.
David or Richard?
You're right, of course. And it reminds me that people don't always do things, going back to the Chicago school, do things because of what's right, maybe because of the economics. Gunnar Dibwad, who is a professor and a visionary in the field of intellectual disabilities, I asked him once as we were driving somewhere, what will cause ultimately the end of institutions for people with intellectual disabilities? And I thought he'd give me some, you know, philosophical answer or some answer about people's rights. And he said the money. He said it'll eventually, this is the other end from what you're saying, it'll cost too much. And I just want to add here, I neglected to mention another group, another development that I think will help move things forward. And that's the experience of the soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. The war there, and I've met folks, I'm involved with an organization that donates Segways, those mobility machines, to permanently disabled soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. The war there and the explosions of these IEDs is causing such tremendous loss to really amazing young men and women. And those folks who are coming back are going to insist also on changes in the way people with disabilities are treated.
And we're going to help them.
I have a question. This is Dan Goldstein, and it's principally for David. I don't find the demographic solution quite as simple as you suggest. If the great growth in the disability community is going to be among seniors who are newly disabled and may not have skills or a philosophy about disability, and there are substantial societal resources going to their sustenance and support and addressing the problems created by disability, that can end up creating a very powerful charity narrative that is contrary to our rights narrative, both in the community at large and also by the consumers of those programs. And it also strikes me that use of societal resources for those purposes may stir some resentment within the rest of the American community and drive some prejudice further. And then also I thought, you know, if I were sitting here either as a Hispanic, a woman, or an immigrant, I might say, wait a minute, so where exactly is the tipping point in the demographics where those fights are over because there are enough of us? So I'd be interested in your thoughts on those issues.
You may be right, and those are all good points. And I also was conscious as I prepared these remarks of the that exclusion from what I was saying of folks internationally, how this affects the world's rights developments and other developments, and of people who are in the United States but not citizens, and who gets counted or who doesn't get counted in a lot of the numbers that I presented. So there's certainly sort of a lot more thinking to be done on this, and I appreciate what you said, Dan.
This is Bob Dinnerstein. David, thank you for your, as usual, provocative comments. I couldn't help but think when you said in 20 years we won't have the ADA that it sort of resonated with Justice O'Connor saying in Grutter, in 25 years we won't need affirmative action. And just as I think she's wrong, I think you're wrong. I suspect you're doing it for rhetorical purposes, which I appreciate. But my question really, and I would think that part of the answer about whether the ADA survives sort of goes to some of the things that Judge Brown was saying, which is the sort of background way in which law operates in this society and the need, I think, to have enshrined certain protections, which we hope might be needed less, but nevertheless, if you were to take them away, we would be worried about. But that's actually not my question. My question is, and this I think we saw very much with the pre-2008 ADA, and that is the forcefulness with which we have been put into a situation of this kind of endless looking into categories of disability and subcategories of disability, and are essentially, are you the kind of person Congress had in mind to be able to bring this case or that case? And it seems to me that as a legal matter, and that fits very well with a sort of civil rights model that many of us have grown up with, And yet it seems to work at cross purposes to the kind of universal design principles that you've identified, that in the very act of trying to show that you, you know, have a condition which gets covered seems to be a separating type of act rather than a kind of inclusive. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
I mean, those issues are, first, they're not unique to the disability area. They affect gender discrimination, race discrimination, religious discrimination. And it's a contradiction so that's built into the way the laws are written and the rights are defined. So there's, I don't have any way to escape that contradiction except by my suggestion, not that the ADA will be repealed, but that if a lot of things happen during these coming years, we will be in a position to not need it. So I don't assume that the future I envision is one that will occur unless a lot of people here and elsewhere do a lot to make it happen. But that contradiction, how we define ourselves into a group at the same time that we're trying to establish that we should be treated like everyone else, is really built into the way our system is structured.
Adrian Ash.
Go ahead.
I have a question for Judge Brown. I want to thank you and David Frilliger for these wonderful talks. But it actually relates, I think, to some of the questions that are going on here. You talked about how the importance of critical legal studies and what it taught you. I'm wondering if you would comment on the confirmation of Justice Sotomayor, how her ethnic origins, her family origins were used very much as part of her narrative. Her disability was, it would seem to me, rather suppressed. I'm wondering, I mean, in terms of the regarded as clause and the kind of universal design versus the categorical notions that drive some of the debates we're having, what would it mean to get people in this society to think about her or the next Supreme Court justice nominee or as someone with a disability doing a job? I'm just wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, I think who people are, what are how we were brought up, our philosophies, like I said in my talk, our perceptions of this history, economics plays a big part in what we're going to be like as judges. And I think that's really important with regard to whoever is going to be the next Supreme Court justice. I don't know that there's a justice out there with a disability who's going to be considered by President Obama or not, but I think it's important that that person have some, to use President Obama's word, empathy for persons with disabilities. And I think that we got to do that across the board, as I said. I don't know if I've answered your question, but I think it's really important that it be brought to the forefront in questions.
I didn't ask it very well, but it would seem to me that Justice Sotomayor's fact of disability was much suppressed, and I'm wondering what would it have taken, or would it, do you think, have made less likely that she would ultimately have been a disability? I don't even know for sure what her philosophy of disability is, but.
Well, now, you know, that's interesting. I was a finalist for the Seventh Circuit, and I was told by a person who was close to the situation not to talk about my disability at all in the interviews, that people already knew my disability and I shouldn't bring it up because if I brought it up, they would see it as trying to curry favor because of my disability. And now, you know, I mean, I thought it was really important that I had a disability, and I had to bite my tongue because I wanted to talk about how important it is to have people with disabilities on the court. But I bit my tongue. And I think maybe that's what the advice that Justice Sotomayor was given too. Bite your tongue, because people don't want to hear it. It'll come out to the people that need to hear it. And I think that, I don't know whether that advice is sound, but that's the advice that's given.
In our society, disability is often regarded as a matter of shame. And I, for my part, have had it with that shame, so I talk about it. I don't know what I'd do if I were nominated. I suspect, but I don't know. We have some disability workshops coming, and they are a disability in the Constitution, facilitated by Charlie Brown. We have real jobs, realizing first-rate employment, the next generation, and that's facilitated by Ruby Moore, who's executive director of the Georgia Advocacy Office. We have the ADA Amendments Act, Real Experience, Real Questions, which will be facilitated by Eve Hill, senior vice president of the Burton Blatt Institute. And we have new strategies to improve the practice of disability law. And that's Robert Dinnerstein, who is professor of law and director of clinical programs of the American University of Washington College of Law. And we do have time for a brief break, I think. So if we could do that and then go to the disability workshops. And we'll reconvene at noon. Tom Perez says that he has a very brief time to meet with us at noon. So if you would try to be there at noon, otherwise you might miss part of what he has to say.